first came here to wander these mountains, my heart was tattered and torn. Ever the rover and all the world over, no land ever felt like a home. But here in the crags and the bogs and the valleys, I've found some measure of ease, where the song of the wind is as sweet to behold as the beautiful rose of Tralee. And it's high up.
Well, good morning. Setting the tone this morning. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for the 17th day of September. It is Wednesday. It is 9:30 in the morning, and we thank you for being with us. A delight to have you with us on the program. We have a lot to talk about. We have great panelists, and of course, we have the effort underway to make money to fill the lockbox, and it's going quite nicely. Thank you very much. We have to keep it up, and I know it takes a few moments out of the show, although not that much time. And it is it's very beneficial because what we want to do is maybe end the fund drive before it even begins, which is the idea. So WAMC.org. If you got a moment, WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you, and we will get started. And we have some really cool stuff. We're going to be it's going to be a good show. And if it's not, it's my fault. Totally my fault. Academic and founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College, Roger Berkowitz joins us this morning. Hello, Roger. How are you?
I'm great, Joe. Great to be here.
I've made this comment a few times, but I mean it, which is that I'm always thrilled when new guests join us. I'm even more thrilled when they come back.
Hey, it's good to
you
be
know,
back.
We try not to be an intimidating bunch, but we're just very, very happy that you're back. Give me a sense of you have this joy event coming up in October, not too long, not very far away, less than a month. Yeah. And the 16th and 17th at Bard College, a Loving the World in Dark Times. Speak. Preach, brother. Preach.
Well, I think we all, a lot of us, on all across the political spectrum are feeling the darkness of the times. And whether it's politics or AI or the environment or whatever it is people are concerned about. And I think there's a lot of people who just can't stop talking about the negatives and all the problems, and that's good. We should talk about them. But I really do believe that if you're going to make the world better, you have to believe in something. You have to have something you're fighting for. I think all of us are very clear about what we're fighting against. Very few of us are actually clear about what we're fighting for these days. And joy is that experience of transcendence, whether it's given through religion or politics or family or teaching, I mean, where I find joy. And I think it's important for us to know what we love and what really brings us great meaning and pleasure in the world. And we're gathering an enormously talented and wonderful group of speakers, Bill T. Jones, Teju Cole, Shane McRae, the poet, a lot of poets actually coming, Ilya Kaminsky, together to talk about how to access, think about, and mobilize our joy in order to live in dark times.
Nothing quite like centering our souls by having poets present. That's very important. Joy, Loving the World in Dark Times, a Common Inquiry hosted by the Hannah Arendt Center at Bard College. It takes place Thursday and Friday, the 16th and 17th of October. You can find out more information by going to HAC, Hannah Arendt Center, hac.bard.edu to find out more information. And what a great event. Thank you for putting it together, and best of luck with it.
Thanks.
Sounds
very much.
Really wonderful. All right. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois joins us. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Doing well. I want to I agree. We need a lot more joy, empathy, care, concern, outreach to people who think differently than we do is a good thing that can start with each one of us. And also on the fun drive, I'd like to say it's always great to hear that there are new members broadening the community, becoming part of the community. So thanks for everyone, and particularly new members.
Thank you for pointing that out. We noticed just over the few days that we've been doing this that both sustaining members and new members, those numbers are rising. And that's wonderful. I mean, when you're planning for an uncertain future, that's a really great thing to have. So thank you for pointing that out.
I noticed when I was on the phones the last time, and I just think that's really, really important. I remember in the past the data on the number of people who listen as opposed to the number of people who are members of part of the community, and it's really great to see that that's broadening the base. Really wonderful. Thanks to everybody who's listening.
We welcome Joseph Palamountain, junior chair, and he's Joseph Palamountain, junior. He's not a junior chair.
Right.
I just want. He's a stool. I can be a junior chair, too.
North
totally fine.
Differentiate that.
Punctuation matters, Joe.
Yeah, I know. Doesn't it, though?
Junior chair.
In government at Skidmore College, Bo Breslin is with us. Good morning, Bo. How are you?
I'm well, Joe. Very excited to be here, especially with fellow panelists who are stellar.
Yeah, it's a good group. And we also have Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, is with us. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good, Joe. And, you know, it's ironic because people often equate me with joy.
Yeah.
No, so I feel the warmth. Yes.
It's the first emotion I feel when I see you. It's like, oh, look, he's exuding joy.
So, you know, that and a ray of sunshine. I know we're going to talk about Constitution Day, but today is also National Apple Dumpling Day. So have a dumpling and a constitution for your joy.
Oh, my God. I love apple dumplings.
Yeah. I knew that, Teresa. That was
I didn't know it was Apple Dumpling Day. Yet another reason to go to
Lakeside. No one's asking
Lakeside
to speak about Apple Dumpling Day.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Well,
it
know,
is sweet, though. It's a sweet thing to talk
it's
about.
It's always tomorrow's show.
See, he brought joy to me.
You know, right now there's people writing going, I'd rather you talk about apple dumplings than the stuff you're going to talk about.
And other people saying, why are you talking about apple dumplings when Gaza is happening?
You do know our listenership very well.
That would be me when I was listening.
it's wonderful to have you all here. Thank you very much. Yes, it is Constitution Day and Citizenship Day. And this is an American federal observance that recognizes the adoption of the United States Constitution and those who have become U.S. citizens. It is observed on the 17th day of September. And check your watch, check your calendar, ask your smartphone. It is the 17th of September. And this is the day in 1787 that delegates in the Constitutional Convention signed the document in Philadelphia. Lest you think that we just slapped this show together and it's just by the seat of our pants, far from it. But both Bo and Teresa approached me a couple weeks ago and said, Constitution Day is coming up. We're on the show together. Can we start off and talk about Constitution Day? And incredibly impressed that they had planned. Because I'm not used to that, is wonderful. And then, of course, the subject is such importance, especially now. Add Roger Berkowitz and Bob Griffin into the conversation. So we're going to talk about the news of the day. I promise you, we will. There are things that we need to get to, but I do want to stress and talk a little bit because obviously this all fits in. About Constitution Day, and I know at least two of our guests are going to be speaking on the subject at their public libraries, and so it's a big deal and something that should be observed, and we will do exactly that on the program this morning to observe it. So, Bo Breslin, I'll let you start.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. This is this is a big day and on the calendar for me. I've been a student of the Constitution and I've taught and written and so on for 40 years now. So Constitution Day is a big deal. And I will just say one thing, because I know people are eager to talk about the current events. The U.S. Constitution changed the world, and it has flaws, and I've always been a fan of trying to reform the U.S. Constitution, but it changed the world. Akhil Amar, the great Yale law professor, called it the linchpin of human history, not American history, human history. And the way it changed the world, it was the only written constitution in late 18th century America. If you put the Articles of Confederation, written national constitution, was the only one at the time. And today, of the 200-plus countries of the world, only three don't have a written constitution. It absolutely fundamentally changed the world. It's the most important document. Sorry, those who are Jeffersonians and the Declaration of Independence is not that. The U.S. Constitution is the most important document ever written. It ranks up there, King James Bible. And so I celebrate it every day, but certainly on September 17th.
Teresa.
Yes, and I think given all of the stories we're talking about today and all of what's going on in our country always, but particularly in the last couple of months, really understanding the Constitution is very important. And I'm wonky enough that I think book clubs, you know, could, as their book, they should consider the Constitution as a subject matter just to have a better understanding of it. Or if you want to donate to libraries, you can get those pocket constitutions, and which are really great resource guides for schools, libraries, whatever. But the part that I want to mention today is something that I learned about a few years ago that really has made a big impression on me, which is that the U.S. Constitution is really based on the role of Native Americans in shaping our Constitution, because our U.S. Constitution, is the framework of it, is really based on what's something called the Great Law of Peace. And this was the guiding document for a coalition of six Native American tribes who together became the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. And these were six warring nations. They were fighting amongst one another. And the person became known as the Great Peacemaker, brought them together, and over many years worked in conjunction with all of them to try to figure out a way where they could operate independently but live together in a coherent way and have some shared resources. And they developed the Great Law of Peace, and it was finalized actually through an event in Cohoes, New York, where I'm from. And if you go to the Cohoes Falls Overlook Park, there is actually a plaque there, because several years ago, some land was returned to the descendants because it's considered sacred land where the Great Law of Peace was finalized. But these troops, the tribes, the Mohawks, the Oneidas, the Onondagas, the Cayugas, and the Senecas, and they came together. And if you put the Great Law of Peace side by side with our Constitution, you'll see that it's really the basis of that. And Ben Franklin came to Albany and learned of it, met with some tribal leaders, went back to Philadelphia. Some Native American leaders came to Philadelphia and helped shape what our Constitution currently is. Now, interestingly enough, one of the things that the original Founding Fathers left out was the important role of women in the Great Laws of Peace, and it took them quite a long time to get up to speed on that. But in any case, I urge you to PBS, just Google it. You can find information in PBS. But in other places, there was the Senate hearings in 1987 that affirmed that our Constitution was framed on the Great Law of Peace and the role of Native Americans in shaping our country. So I just wanted to share that because it was an oh wow moment for me when I first learned it. And I just think now more than ever, we need to remind ourselves about what our Constitution is, what its origins came from, how it's been shaped over time, and how it's being reshaped this year.
Well, Roger Berkowitz.
Thanks, Joe. The Constitution is a written document, and it has different parts. I think when I went to law school, and I think many of us who studied law, and I think many of us in the United States think of the Constitution, we often highlight the Bill of Rights, right? The first 10 amendments to the Constitution, which were not actually in the Constitution when it was written. They were added in as a compromise at the end, and really weren't that important in the first 100 years of the country. It became much more important in the 20th century. There's a question of what part of the Constitution is sort of central today. The Bill of Rights are central, and they become part of what it means to be an American. The First Amendment, which, you know, is an absolute bulwark of the United States, is essential. But when I teach constitutional law, we often focus, at least for most of the class, on the structural separation of powers. That was one of the great innovations of the United States. Comes out of Montesquieu. Comes out of as well the Roman and Italian city states. And the question is, how do you prevent any one organization power from taking over, from becoming a tyranny? That's what the founders were really obsessed with. And they knew that any one branch, any whether it's executive, legislative, or the courts, could become tyrannical. And so they thought, not only do we want to create three branches, but we want to create the states and we want to create local communities. And what they tried to do was disperse power through as many different organizations, as many different institutions as possible. And the idea was that if one power got too powerful, one ring to control them all, others would gang up to oppose them. And that structural federalism, that structural separation of powers, dispersal of powers, is to me one of the great innovations, the rejection of sovereignty in the United States, that there's one institution that is sovereign. And that's what leads to the kind of democratic contestation and sometimes violence at the core of the United States. And yet it also is what I think is at the source of the protection of liberty and freedom here.
Bob Griffin.
You know, Joe, almost every single topic that we talk about is linked back to the Constitution. So whether we talk about Bondi's conversation about hate speech, whether we talk about military attacks on boats in open waters, whether we talk about the potential closure of the government because Congress can't pass a budget, these are all linked back to this seminal document. And I agree with you, Teresa, that people need to read the document. They also, I think, we should be teaching civics at a greater level in multiple levels of our education system, much more so than we have in the past. I think we became complacent as a country, thinking that laws were settled and that these rights that we have are guaranteed, and they're not. And we're seeing that right now. I can tell you in my time in both government and in life, I've never felt that the Constitution is more under threat than it is today. And, Roger, I really appreciate your comments about the idea of the balance of power. And Beau's comment about the Constitution is an imperfect document. And the idea of trying to treat it as if it's some God-given or ordained language, it wasn't. It was an act of compromise. It was an act of balance. And in many respects, it purposely created an inefficient system in order to protect the core civil liberties and the idea of that we don't have a sovereign. So when we talk about the Supreme Court giving sovereign-like immunity to the president, when we talk about rollback of civil liberties, when we talk about control of the press, when we talk about government agencies being used specifically to further the personal ambitions of a family. These are all constitutional issues, and I don't know how many articles we're going to get to today or issues we're going to get to today, Joe. But every one of them is connected back to the Constitution. One final thought before you go on. The Constitution is a document that needs our protection. Because it's at right now where we are, it's what saves the people from the oligarchs.
Roger,
yeah, I want to just follow up on that because I think it's really important. I mean, the Constitution is an imperfect document, right? As you said, and yet I think that what really made America into the kind of country in which freedom was valued and seen as a beacon around the world. Was this worship of the Constitution that came about in the 19th century? And it wasn't a worship of the document, of the paper. It was a worship of the idea that the Supreme Court had authority, that they would be able to, you know, we didn't always agree with them, but they were the people who were trying to interpret the Constitution, and it was what bound us as a people. And today, with every article in which you say, well, decided by an appointee by Obama or decided by an appointee by Biden, which on the one hand, I understand it. People care about these things. On the other hand, it does increasingly delegitimize law and the rule of law and the idea of a constitutional republic, which is what we are. And if that continues and if people keep thinking of it that way, you're never going to get back the kind of respect for constitutional republicanism, small r republicanism that we need. And so I think all of us have – it's a tough call. Do you identify who the judges are? I mean, or do you not? And obviously it's become politicized, so it's sort of a head in the sand kind of moment if you don't. And yet we're in that kind of double bind.
Joe, do we have time for a quick story?
Actually, let's take a break and then we'll come back and we can tell all the stories you want, at least for 9 minutes. We'll take a break and we'll be right back after this.
Their faces forgotten, their stories remain to speak of unbearable pain.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Real quick, Joe Jenks is the music that we're listening to, award-winning folk singer and songwriter playing the Eighth Step at Proctor's on the 20th of this month, so this weekend, eighthstep.org, the number 8, eighthstep.org for more information. And you can see the playlist at wamc.org/roundtable. Bo, tell me a story.
Okay, so I can never resist the story. I'll keep it to a minute or so. But it builds off of what Bob and Roger were talking about in terms of reverence and worship for the Constitution and what Teresa was talking about in terms of understanding and reading it. So we're back in late 18th century America. Anti-federals, those who oppose ratification of the Constitution, want a Bill of Rights. And Roger mentioned the Bill of Rights. Madison makes the pledge, right? He's running for Congress, and he makes the pledge that he'll put a Bill of Rights. That'll be the first order of business when he gets into Congress. He wins his election, he goes to Congress, and the first order of business is he has a list of freedoms, a list of Bill of Rights. This was a compromise to the Anti-Federalists in exchange for ratification. There are 19 on that list. You can see his original list in the National Archives. I implore people to go to the National Archives and see his original list. So Madison proposes 19 amendments. 19 is consolidated to 17. 17 becomes 12 because two-thirds of both houses pass 12 of those, and 10 are eventually ratified by the states. That's why we have 10 rights in the Bill of Rights. But two things that are important about this story. One is his First Amendment, the First Amendment that we think of sort of first among equals with the right of freedom of speech and freedom of religion and the Establishment Clause, freedom of the press, and so on, was his third. It was not his first. And the reason why, and this is the point I want to make, the reason why it was third is because Madison believed the constitutional amendments ought to just be embedded in the actual text, Bob. They're not additions to the end of the document. He thought they should be embedded in the original text. And so Congress shall make no law, ... ought to be in Article 1, Section 8. And when it became clear that it was not going to be embedded in the actual text, that has had repercussions for American society since, because we see the original constitutional text as unamendable, as sacred, as worshipful, reverential, because you cannot change the original text. Amendments go at the end. They're seen as additions. But the original text technically has not changed since 1787, and that contributes to our worship, which I would say is a problem.
But it's worship, but it's also an interpretation, and things that did not seem to be, for want of a better term, well, I think it's an accurate term, for a crisis, where we're wringing our hands and saying, oh, my God, I didn't think that could happen under our Constitution. Those things are happening. So it's our interpretation that is changing.
Well, sort of. So, and historically, there have been moments of crisis, the Civil War being the most prominent. But not only. I mean, you know, I'm a huge fan. But if you really want to know who changed the scope of executive power, it's FDR. You know, and sure, Trump is testing every possible limit from this moment on, and this is probably a good segue into our current conversation, current events conversation. But FDR was the big sort of game changer for executive power. And so, yes, you're right, Joe. Interpretation has made a big difference. And in many ways, interpretation by the Supreme Court has changed the direction of the country in ways that Roger alluded to. At the end of the day, though, our Constitution is still 8 out of 10 people still revere it, and it is filled with flaws. Now, I'm trying to be joyful all day because that's the theme of the day. So I'll go back to my point that the Constitution changed the world in a positive way.
Here's what I don't understand, Teresa. Maybe you can help me out with this. We've got about 2 minutes. But I say it in setting these articles, and we say it on the panel almost every day, to Bob's point, almost every day. This happened. They decided to do this, pause, which is most likely unconstitutional.
Right.
And yet, it continues. And then it's paused, and then it continues, and then it's paused, and then it continues.
Well, that just is a reflection of the enormous stress test right now on our Constitution. And so the question is, will the Constitution endure this stress test? And I think the answer lies in all of us. I was, going back to Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address, a key phrase that I think is important here, of the people, by the people, for the people, right? And where he notes that our democratic structure is rooted in our citizens. You know, this is our democracy. And it's really up to us, right, whether or not we're going to endure this moment. And I think it's interesting to note what's happening on Constitution Day. The President of the United States is in the United Kingdom meeting with the King, right? And then, leaders tomorrow, but on Constitution Day. So that is a reminder that we came to be out of a revolution against the King, right? And so now here we are celebrating with great pomp and circumstances. Times can change. Things can change. Relationships can change. Is that wacky to say? Everybody's laughing.
No, it's a great observation. He's acting as a peer to the King rather than what I would argue a president should be acting.
But also, I agree with you on that. But even looking past Trump's behavior, just as simple, if it's possible, hard for me.
I'd love to see you wacky, though.
I know. I'm odd. I am an odd duck, but I'm always looking.
Hardly.
I'm always looking for the hopeful sign. Like, you know, think about the U.S. and Japan and the crisis we faced, and now a close ally. Think about the symbolism of on Constitution Day that this meeting, this welcoming, is happening. How it's just a reminder that even though there are deeply dark times, things can change, but also a warning sign because the president who's gone there is acting like a king. So what direction are we going in? It's not up to anybody else. It's up to each one of us to make that decision by our actions.
Certainly.
Lecture over.
Certainly a great prescription to end this part of the conversation. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a lot of letters. I want to get to those, and then we'll get to other stories making news today. Fabulous panel talking about really important stuff. We welcome your letters. We're getting a lot. Panel@WAMC.org. We are going to go hear a few messages. We're going to go over to Sarah LeDuc and David Gustina as they talk about the importance of the lockbox and the import of funding and supporting this radio station so we can continue to have conversations like this on the air and talk about the important issues of our time. We will continue all of it right after this. You've asked me here to tell. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have a good one going, and we welcome you to be a part of it. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. It's Wednesday, the 17th of September. That is Constitution Day, and we are talking about Constitution Day on the program this morning with four experts who are just amazing, and we are so lucky and so proud to present them to you, especially on this morning, but every day that they are here is special. I'm going to reintroduce them just so you know who's on the panel, and then we're going to go to the many, few of the many letters that we got, and then we'll move on to other things as we work our way through our last half hour together. We have founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College. Roger Berkowitz is here. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois. Joseph Palamountain, junior chair in government at Skidmore College. Bo Breslin, and dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin.
Joyful Bob Griffin.
Yes, joyful, joyful Bob Griffin. 1-800-323-9262 if you want to help the lockbox. 800-323-9262 if you want to help the lockbox. WAMC.org. And I don't know where that came from. Let's go to a couple of the letters that we got. Kate writes, I think the people and organizations on the right are steering this country. Trump is just the charismatic mouthpiece. Well, that's one of those chicken and egg questions, right?
It is, but you know, you have to have somebody to carry out your policies. I mean, so just saying this is just the act of one person, I think is incorrect. That there is a whole movement behind a lot of the changes. And one also observation about the Constitution, Joe. In my mind, the Constitution was always about the empowerment of the people and the limitations of government, that it's intended to be safeguards that hemmed in the power of government. And I think that becomes really important part of the conversation that we're having, because what we're seeing is safeguards are getting blown through, which can fundamentally change how the country operates, including the use of federal police powers, the use of military in domestic settings, all of these issues. So as we talk about Constitution Day and continue on with that theme, government officials who are trying to implement some of the sweeping changes that Trump is signing in through, particularly through executive orders, are going to continue to push to weaken the Constitution because of those guardrails.
And the check against that is that those who have power, i.e. the Republicans in the House and the Senate, have to assert that power.
Well, the guardrails are supposed to be, Congress is supposed to stand up for their rights, which they haven't, and the courts are supposed to be independent, which I would argue they're not. So now we're into what Roger was talking about, the sort of the into the safety layer of the state versus federal powers, which is why I think it's a healthy pushback from, you know, Pritzkers and Newsoms and Hochuls and in the blue states on what's going on. The same way I thought it was healthy that Texas and Florida were pushing back against the Biden administration, because again that's a proper test of the constitutional system.
Yeah, and it's a couple of quick things about what Bob is saying right on. It's a little bit of an awkward dance we're doing, those of us on the moderate left, Democrat, you know, to be, and I think you're absolutely right, I think Roger's absolutely right, but it's an awkward dance to be sponsoring and supporting the power of states. Usually that's a right-wing principle. And so now here we are, those of us on the Democratic side, sort of celebrating the pushback of the states. The other thing I'll say to Bob, right on again, is that a constitution of enumerated powers is a constraint, as you said, on government. The problem is our Constitution is the shortest in the world at 4,500 words. It's basically the size of a cover article for People magazine. It's not long, and so government institutions can work in the absences, as the Trump administration has shown.
We do welcome your letters on our discussion this morning. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Michael says, what's to be done when the Supreme Court really doesn't follow the Constitution, such as their recent decision to redefine unreasonable search and seizure as applied to Hispanics?
Yeah, so, I think there are a lot of things that are happening with regard to the Supreme Court. It's clearly it's clearly shifted to the right. There was a fascinating, a piece on NPR this morning where they were talking about the way in which Chief Justice Roberts sort of incrementally tests some of these conservative interpretations with small, he's able to sort of move the court with small decisions, and then boom, he'll come up with a big decision that moves it all to the right. So I think the Supreme Court is part of the puzzle here, part of the problem, in my opinion. But so are the other two branches.
Just can I make a quick note on that?
Of course.
I think it's important for us to try and stick somewhat closely to the facts. So the Supreme Court didn't make a decision about the Fourth Amendment as it relates to Hispanics. The shadow docket, right, which is a problem in itself, where the Supreme Court, before the case has come up through the normal procedures and is then comes to be decided by the Supreme Court, there was an emergency request made that the Supreme Court address this question of whether in some sense, profiling people was a violation of the Fourth Amendment, and it chose not to uphold an emergency injunction in that case. I think the emergency docket and the shadow docket is being wildly abused and overused right now, and I think that's dangerous for the authority of the Supreme Court. But the court hasn't made a decision on that, and I think it's important for us to understand that. At the same point, I do believe, and Joyful Bob and I agree on this, that the court has a big role in our country, and it is there to interpret the Constitution. But at some point, the laws and the Constitution are paper tigers. They don't have power except the power of authority. They're not going to be able to resist an active movement on the executive, the legislative, the states, whatever, to overrun civil rights. It's up to the people, right? And what the Constitution gives the people here is the right to free speech, the right to assemble, the right to organize, the right to to elect people and unelect people. To expect the court to protect us from tyranny, I think, is a wild misunderstanding of our constitutional system. The way the United States Constitution thinks that we're going to be protected from tyranny is through the separation of powers and through the ballot box. That's the last place of resistance. And the court can hold on for some long. The courts can hold on for a certain point. But in the end, the courts are not going to be able to save us. And we should expect it.
And I absolutely agree. I think the ultimate firebreak here is the vote, is our vote. And one of the things that I find deeply disturbing is a little article the other day about how the Trump administration is demanding voter information, voter rolls from states. I can't remember the number so far. But the question is why? What are they doing with that data? Because one of the saving graces of our system, our electoral system, is it's very dispersed and it's not centrally managed. And so I do think that one of the things that we have to be paying attention to is those who know much more about this than me have to really focus and draw attention to the mechanics of our ability to vote and vote in a fair
way. I don't disagree. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, you know, and this is actually a really important letter because it gets to something I think that gets lost a lot is that there's a lot of anger at the Supreme Court, and I think a great deal of it's deserved. At the same time, though, the branch of government that I think has failed us the most is Congress. Mm-hmm. And this has gone on for decades, though, Joe. They've been lazy in how they pass laws, right, leaving the most important parts to the bureaucracy and process rather than working through what the laws should say. If you think about the current conditions that we have right now, Congress gave up their rights on tariffs. They've given up their rights on the budget. The number of continuing resolutions, the number of years that have gone by without having proper review and votes, the fact that there isn't accountability right now for the members of Congress because they don't vote on anything, you know, to me it's the biggest failure of government in federal government right now rests at the feet of Congress.
I don't disagree. And do we have a second?
Oh, well, I was just going to say, just interstitial, but I was just going to say, it strikes me when you talk about like the budget, this Congress says, okay, you've got till we've moved it now to November. We've saved government shutdown to November 4th, and it's like they built Stonehenge. I mean, they're all patting each other on the back and saying, this is the greatest thing in the world.
Right.
But that's the abdication that you were talking about. Let me go to Bo.
I totally agree with all of you, and I'm right with Joyful Bob on the fact that that Congress is shamefully incompetent. That said, the design of our political system, in reference to, I'm all about the vote, elections matter. The design of our political system is such that each of the four institutions of the American national government are supposed to be representing the interests of different groups, right? So House of Representatives, it's all about local constituencies, two-year terms and so on. That's why Senate is all about the interests of the states. That's why you don't split them in half. You have six-year terms. The president's the only one elected by the entire population, and the court. This is why I think the court has failed miserably. The court is supposed to protect the interests of those who do not have a voice in the political process. And fixed salaries and life tenure is the design feature that allows the court to be outside of politics. So I'm not sure I'm with you, Roger, on the fact that it's not the central bulwark against tyranny. It is the central bulwark, and that's why there are life tenure and fixed salaries for federal court judges.
But, Bo, we have the court we have now because the Congress didn't operate in the way it was supposed to, right? Because the Republicans, Mitch McConnell, I'm talking about you, right? He stretched the boundaries of how things were supposed to work, and this is what we ended up with. Right.
Yeah,
so it all is integrated.
No. That's what Roger's talking about with checks and balances and separation of powers and so on, and Madison's genius in so many ways. I don't disagree with all of that. And I don't disagree that with the vote being the most powerful tool we have. What I'm saying is the court has lost sight of its central purpose as representing the interests of those who do not have a voice in the political process.
I don't disagree with it. But
Since Roger's name was mentioned three times, I feel like we should at least go to Roger.
It's Joyful Bo now that is.
Yeah.
I don't know where you're, or, you know, I don't know if the court is really there to represent the people who have no voice. I mean, that's not in the Constitution, but I think the court is there to represent as much as possible a non-political assessment of the Constitution, not as just a written document, but of what constitutes us as a people, who we are. And it's an attempt to try and, nine justices sit there and try and say, you know, is this compatible with who we are as a people? And it's supposed to be an apolitical, non-political attempt to do that. That said, we live in a political democracy where things are very political. And here I very much agree with Joyful Bob. which is that, you know, the whole system was set up around, as Madison explained in Federalist 51, that all the different institutions of federal power were supposed to be jealous and ambitious.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to pursue their interests. And Congress has completely abdicated for the last 50 years its interests. For one reason is campaign finance. They don't want to get on the wrong side of the issue and they want to raise more money. Gerrymandering, which to me is one of the great real problems of our system right now, has created a more radicalized, more extreme Congress than was ever imagined by the founders. And I think Congress is broken. And, you know, the political question doctrine, which Bo knows very well, has been around for a long time. Supreme Court basically says between the president and the Congress, we're not going to get too much involved. And that's part of its apoliticalness. It doesn't want to make those decisions. And the problem is if the Congress abdicates its role and the court says we're not going to get involved in these decisions, the president's going to win every time. And that's the situation we're in. And so I really do think we have to demand Congress act. And I think you're only going to do that if you can somehow ameliorate the extremism in Congress through somehow responding to the threat of gerrymandering. And I don't know how we do that. I have a lot of ideas. But I think that's really the root of what is going on right now.
Term limits.
We have just a few moments before we go over to Lockbox Central. And I want to just go over a couple of these letters. First, we go to Polly. The definition of political discourse has broadened to include opinions unrelated to any particular political issue. Doxing college professors because they wrote a letter that one disagrees with is not political. It is criminal. Then we go to Theodore. Does your panel believe that the Constitution is legally in force today? I believe that it is not. And a joyful goal to stand up for is to reinstate it in at least some of the states.
Well, all right. The doxing question, I think, is a really interesting one, right? I mean, and Pam Bondi talked about this in her whatever the other day.
or whatever.
Well, I mean, she's on social. I mean, I don't know what to call it. On social media or on a podcast. I mean, the Attorney General is like a podcaster these days, as is the president, as a tweeter or a social media person, whatever it's called. You know, it really, you know, look, I think doxing is in bad form. We have a definition of doxing. If people don't know what it is, but it's basically when you publish the name and home phone number and address of people who you don't like in order to help people to either protest them or kill them. And, you know,
right. The key, my understanding of it is the key term is with malicious intent.
Yeah.
And I find doxing awful. Right. And yet, The same Pam Bondi who defended doxing when it was done by people doxing professors at Harvard and Columbia is now, you know, angry at doxing when it's done against Republicans. I mean, this is the problem with the free speech debate, is it's become completely cynical. You know, now after 10 years of saying, you know, we don't think hate speech is against free speech. Now you have Pam Bondi and Donald Trump saying we should start prosecuting people who exercise hate speech. And these people are completely cynical. I don't like doxing, but it is protected by the First Amendment so long as you don't incite violence.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll wrap up our conversation today. Real quick letter from Deborah, who says, my blood pressure goes up a notch or two whenever Bo and Teresa are on together. I think that's a compliment.
I don't think so.
Love WAMC, and Deborah says, I am all for mobilizing our joy. We will leave you in the wonderful hands of Sarah LaDuke and David Gastina to talk about the importance of our lockbox. This group will be back in just a matter of moments to wrap up our conversation this morning on this Constitution Day. We welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org.
On this journey, afraid I will not reach that distant shore. I cry for help, feel like I'm sinking. There is no one near me.
Good morning. Welcome to let's try that again. Welcome back to the Roundtable. And it's very nice to have you here. And we are talking about Constitution Day, and it really made it a focal point of our conversation this morning. We have four incredible panelists, and of course, your letters, panel@wamc.org. I would like to read a couple of the letters that we got that we haven't gotten to yet, and then move on and talk about within that idea of Constitution Day, some of the things that are going on today that highlight many of the points that have been made over the last hour and a half. Again, we welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. David writes, Native American culture gave us the concept of balance of power and branches of government. Ben Franklin learned this from the Indians. The Indians were very inclusive and understood that participation of all society was necessary. Women did not hold positions of power, however. Chiefs of tribes were chosen by women. Indians understood the concept of balance of power and its importance for functional society.
That's exactly right. The Great Law of Peace, in fact, did that. And they also, another aspect of it that was not picked up by the Constitution was this seventh generation idea, which is what you do now, what impact will it have seven generations from now? So the environment, think about what that means over the, what your actions mean over the long time, and we could learn from that.
We also go to this letter from Bill. As eager reader of SCOTUS rulings, it seems that the impressive foundational words of the preamble have essentially no meaning in law. Why such impressive words if they don't guide the courts?
I mean, that second part of that question is a really good question. Preambles don't have any sort of litigation heft, right? You can't go into the court and say, you know, the government promised me the blessings of liberty. But the second part of that question is spot on. And what I'll say, and you know me, I'm always going to sort of jump at the opportunity to tell a story. When the original draft of the preamble came out, it was like the Articles of Confederation, and it said, we the people of, and it listed the individual states, so the state of New Hampshire, the state of Massachusetts, and so on. And Gouverneur Morris, New Yorker, who was a delegate from Pennsylvania, was like, nah, that's terrible. We need to rewrite the preamble, and he individually rewrote the preamble to the beautiful, elegant, soaring preamble that we have now. Nobody in the Constitutional Convention nodded at that, or nobody cared about it enough to sort of change it. And so the preamble is Gouverneur Morris's words, and he hit the nail on the head.
Marion writes, how do you protect the subject line of this note is the vote, really? How do you protect the vote and separation of powers without the courts? That from Marion. We're all looking at you, Bob.
I don't know why. It's not just the courts. It's state. It's the power of the states to actually protect the elections. But it also explains why there's been so many attacks on people's access to the vote, their ability to vote, the ease of voting, making, you know, if you think about the movements that have occurred in really the past 10 years, trying to make it more difficult for people to both register and vote. I mean, going out of the way to pass policies and put in place, you know, rules and regulations because they're not passing laws that constrict access to voting. It's because the powers that be and the very smart people in the Heritage Foundation that wrote Project 2025 know that the greatest threat to their takeover of this country is at the ballot box. But that's why the states protecting their rights to hold open and fair elections is so important. And it also gets back to something that isn't really popular, but we need to continue to say on the show, is that every election makes a difference. And it's not good enough to turn out just for the presidential election every 4 years, because what's happening is the degradation of our powers is occurring at every election, including the one for the library commissions and the dog catcher. And any time you're putting somebody in a position of power who is going there in order to take away the people's rights at the local level, that is just as impactful as the president.
And who runs your board of elections, your local board of elections, is critical. It's probably never been more critical. And how it works, I mean, just look back at Georgia, where the president made the phone call to say, I just need whatever, 1,100 votes. And a Republican said no, right? That's how it works, because a Republican cared more about his country than he did about his party. And the question is that going to work the next time? And that's really up to all of us to make sure that all of these things that are in Project 2025 that they're trying to implement now, centralize the voting process and reduce the ability to vote and reduce mail-in voting, all those kinds of things have to be rejected. And we have to pay attention to who is getting elected to appointed to the Board of Elections and you know, who our local leaders are, who our attorney generals are, who are going to fight for these things. Who's the Secretary of State? Can anybody name their Secretary of State? Heck, that's how you protect your voting, right? In most states, is your Secretary of State. I said, heck.
You.
I almost slipped.
All right, let's go back to a couple of letters, and this from Florian. I know this seems like naive niggling. I love that
That's
word.
That's a great word.
But I lost a lot of respect for the body, the Congress, that is, when I learned what seemed to be the impact of C-SPAN and then social media. The Congress doesn't really even debate each other in the open, with rare exception. Instead, public debate is usually four speeches to no one, only to make video clips and to make them all straw men rather than representatives. The public do not get to see their representatives use their intellect and be held accountable for being honest and factual and tangle with the topics of the day. Everyone gets to grandstand in very safe isolation. I simply see that has been emblematic of all the other deeper defective traits of our current Congress.
I think that's right. Mm-hmm. And I would just add to that. It doesn't just happen in those vacuous moments where a Congress member or a senator is standing up giving a speech to nobody. It happens when the Cash Patels of the world are. There's a grandstanding, and we currently see the ex-CDC chief medical officer is testifying. I guarantee when I get home and I pop that on the television, it'll be a lot of grandstanding on both sides of the aisle in Congress.
Well, I having worked in the House and the Senate, I want to disagree with this partially. I think that C-SPAN is an extremely important addition to our democracy. And while it might seem that speaking to an empty chamber is useless, what it does is often put information on the record, and the record becomes what we build for our this is wonky, but how you build policy, how the courts, what do they go back and look at? They look at the congressional record. Where is a congressional record formed? It's formed in the hearings, like the Cash Patel hearing or like this. I think the CDC hearing is critical. And what they say and how they hold people accountable on both sides is critical. And the people can go back and look and see. It's a recorder. They can see it. But it's also in the record, a part of building our laws. I think where the system is broken down is what... And this is not an attack on the media, so how can I wear this properly? What gets rewarded? Because what you see when it gets boiled down to a few seconds is the vitriol. You don't see where they've reached common agreement. You don't see what the core issues are. Like right now, it's very frustrating to me that we're about to pass a budget or not pass a budget that's really going to impact everybody's lives. And the whole issue of debating and discussing the substance of where the cuts are, where the resources are, just doesn't get any light of day because we're talking endlessly about Trump's, you know, fake, you know, litigation, not fake, but he files a lawsuit against the New York Times and that gets a lot of the play or whatever, right? He puts chum in the water and it's a distraction. But I do think that it's really important what's said on the House floor, what's said on the Senate floor, what's said in these hearings, because that lays the groundwork.
Well, let me ask you this question, Teresa. I mean, you're the expert here, and I think you're right about virtually everything you say, but accountability is, I don't know, it's a slippery concept when you have 92% incumbency rate. So people can stand up on, Congress members can stand up on the floor, say virtually whatever they want, and you're right, the media picks and chooses what it, but we still go to the polls and reelect Congress members at a 9 out of 10 rate. That strikes me as we're not holding anybody accountable.
Well, that part of that's, you know, gerrymandering and money and such. But the question, and then some of us have great, I mean, I think my member of Congress, Congressman Paul Tonko, is astounding. Works hard, cares, listens to the people, goes back to the House floor, talks about what matters, right? But, you know, there's a broad stroke here earlier about how none of the people in Congress are upholding their duties to pass a budget. Well, but it's true, and they're working for a continuing resolution. But what did the head of the Democratic leader in the House Appropriations Committee and the Democratic leader in the Senate Appropriations Committee yesterday laid down a line, a marker about whether or not they'll pass this continuing resolution? Three key things: that keep the government open, protect the congressional power of the purse, and improve health care, not allow them to dismantle health care. So that doesn't get any light of day. But all of those things, there are people fighting in the Congress working to try to do what we say is not happening, which is maintain this separation of powers and for the Congress to maintain the power of the purse. Are they getting any attention for that? No, because they're not on the far fringes screaming. They're looking for some points of compromise to get this thing done in a way that protects Congress. And I don't know how you fix that.
By the way, I just want to say to Andrew, who wrote that letter, Teresa watches C-SPAN, so we don't have to.
I do. I watch C-SPAN. I mean, I went back last night, and I listened to the 20-minute press conference that Trump gave as he was getting on the plane. It was filled with stuff that all we were talking about today, which was mind-blowing in some of the things he said.
I would rather watch the minister questions, if you've never seen those.
Yeah, those are great, too. You can watch them on CNN.
There are a couple points there that the work really does get at the committee and subcommittee level.
Right.
I mean, that's where the sausage really gets ground out, and it should be. I mean,
yes.
There's supposed to be, it's supposed to be a more complete idea when it comes to the floor. From my experience in the federal government in the bureaucracy is that I actually really liked to go into classified briefings with members of Congress, because with the cameras off, there was. It just reminded me of how bright the people were that were in Congress, and when they weren't doing the peacocking and they weren't making sure that the right profile is up for the camera, they cared about it, and they were able to reach consensus so much quicker.
Yeah.
I think the cameras there are important. I do think, Citizens United is probably has a bigger impact on a lot of the issues than we're talking about, and that sort of links us back. I would also toss this out to the panel just for reaction. I don't think that the framers of the Constitution ever envisioned having 96-year-old people running for re-election or members of Congress who were in their upper 80s or members of the Supreme Court in their upper 80s, because life expectancy wasn't that, so they didn't even think of this as an issue when they were drafting.
Totally
true. That's
true,
but they also didn't expect C-SPAN, right? And
yeah.
I think accountability is really important, but something Bob just said is also really important, which is that when people are in a room talking to each other without cameras, something called respect and goodwill and friendship even, I mean, I'm always remembered that Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan used to say, we're adversaries during the day, and after 6 o'clock we can be friends and share a drink. That's being lost, and the kind of grandstanding that our media politics has created is not what we expected. The government was not supposed to be representative government, as Madison and Hamilton understood it, was not supposed to be representing the interests of the most radical people in my district. It was supposed to be sifting out people who would be in a room and try and come to common sense agreement through deliberation with each other. And unfortunately, the hyper media oriented culture has really put a damper on that.
Well, I think there's a bigger question here, which we need Jim Hendler for, I think, but it's really the algorithms now in social media.
Quick, get us Hendler.
Hendler on the phone. But you know what I mean? And I can only get the first layer of this, but there's been a lot of discussion about this lately in that you are fed information that sort of confirmation bias. And I mean, I think certainly there's a big difference between people's understanding of the world if they watch Fox only and versus if they watch MSNBC only. I mean, I try to listen and watch Fox and conservative radio. It's a whole different world. But that becomes even more distorted if where you get your news, as most young people do, is on social media because of the algorithms and because it's directing very specific information to people.
We are just about out of time. We have about a minute and change. And I guess I just want to ask whoever would like one or two people for just a few words of how you think a good way those of us listening to take part in Constitution Day and make it more meaningful moving forward.
Yeah, read the text. You know, I mean, and don't Roger's exactly right. Sort of the Bill of Rights has come to shadow the original seven articles. And then ultimately, I think choose to ratify or reject the Constitution after reading it, right? Article 7 was not, and I tell my students, Article 7, the ratification article, is not a fixed moment in time. Technically, it was a fixed moment in time, but we should all have a personal relationship with the Constitution, and we can choose to decide to ratify it, endorse it, think about it in a positive way, or we can take steps to reform it. It's outdated. I think the steps are needed, but at the end of the day, I still revere the text.
I want to remind folks that the Joy Conference, Joy, Loving the World in Dark Times, is happening at the Hannah Arendt Center at Bard College, October 16th and 17th. You can find out more information by going to hac.bard.edu.
Can I make one recommendation for
yes.
Constitution Day? A website called oyez.com. Oyez.org.
How are you spelling that?
O-W-E-Z.
Okay.
And you can listen to cases being argued in front of the Supreme Court with the justice questions and the answers by the attorneys. It's probably the best way to learn how to think about the Constitution.
All right. We're desperately late on time. I love you all. Thank you very much for a great day. Bob, you're ever joyful in my heart. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe.